Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Daniela Mestanek-Young, a former U.S. Army intelligence captain who served two tours in Afghanistan as a member of the female engagement team, which were a part of combat operations there. In fact, she's one of the first U.S. female Army personnel to go into combat. She was also sexually assaulted there while on base. But this was not her first encounter with sexual abuse. Young was born into the Children of God religious cult. She was third generation, a cult that used sex as a way to attract new adherents and as a method of control within it. She grew up in locales around the world, experiencing control, countless traumas, and abuse before escaping the cult at age 15 and moving to the U.S., where she tried to put that life behind her. She put herself through high school, went to college, graduated as a valedictorian before commissioning into the Army. And it was there, she writes, that she began to think about group behavior in high-control organizations, which is a central theme of her memoir, Uncultured. In it, she relates her early life in the cult and compares it to her time in the Army and asks the question, where does a cult end and a culture begin? And the apex between a good organization and a toxic one. Her book, Uncultured, a memoir, is published by St. Martin's Press. Daniela, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your memoir, Uncultured, recounts being born and raised in a religious cult and trading that for a military service, both of which have some cult-like premises to them. But I want to ask, you know, when your only experience in life growing up is an existence outside of cultural norms, I'm interested in how you as a teenager began to disassociate from the group. But first of all, what do we need to know about the family or the Children of God cult?
So the Children of God was started in 1968, which is right in your peak sort of cult era in the U.S. And what's interesting about that is we see cults pop up in times of social change and discomfort and confusion because people like to have that guru. And, you know, so this prophet, self-proclaimed prophet, started sort of collecting all these hippies, grew pretty big, turned it into an international movement. And along the way, in his first decade, he sort of was your typical sort of extreme, very conservative evangelical religion. But then he took one thing and he flipped it. And that one thing was sex. Mm-hmm. So now, instead of this culture of purity and abstinence and sexual control in that way, he had religious prostitutes going out to get men and money for the group. And then he eventually ended up with, you know, Jesus is love and love is sex and sex should be introduced to children in this loving way. So this was kind of became the basis of the group's beliefs. And then aside from that, you know, cults are always about labor. So this cult in the 80s and 90s was about the production of childhood entertainment videos, both religious and non-religious. And then us children were the talent on these videos. We were selling these videos on the streets all over the world. And that was kind of our only interaction with the outside world, as it were, because other than that, we lived in these communes, on these compounds. So to, you know, answer your question of how I, as a teenager, started to disassociate, one of those things was languages. I lived in Brazil, but I lived on American communes in Brazil. And when I was around 10, I lived with a Brazilian woman who taught me Portuguese. And that was very significant for me to be able to speak the language of the outside world around me. And then the other thing was I came to America for the first time in 2001. And I'd always been taught it was evil. And I'd always seen that from the outside in. And then on 9/11, I had this moment I call a crack in the brainwashing, where I was watching live news for the first time, seeing people die and hearing my group sort of praising God for it. And I heard the word religious extremists. And that is when I felt to myself, you know, I need to get away. Maybe we're the wrong ones.
That's interesting. A large part of your youth, you grew up outside of the United States in foreign countries with foreign languages. And I'm wondering how a group like this uses language barriers as a way to normalize behavior or normalize their behavior.
Yes, it's very significant. And, you know, there was actually a a psychologist or organizational psychologist who studied Jonestown both before and after the mass murder, mass suicide. And he specifically said, like, this could not have happened in California if they'd stayed in California. There was the geographical isolation. And that was a big part of the Children of God's strategy, was keeping everybody sort of insecure, unstable. You know, my mother, who was also born and raised in this cult, when she was 14, 15, she was living in the Philippines without her passport, already with children, and sort of physically completely destabilized. I got pretty lucky that when I wanted to leave, I was only in Mexico. So that was kind of a bit of an easier journey for me.
Yeah. And about those who do choose a cult or find a cult, what do we need to know about what they're looking for in life and how this organization, this charismatic leader and the I guess the discipline within the cult appeals to them? What do you suppose appealed to your parents and your relatives that were a part of this group?
Yeah, you know, for me, it was my grandparents who joined, and my grandfather's story was sort of your average person that joins a cult, which is the only thing scholars have identified is the quality of being a seeker. So my grandfather had been through college. He was a smart man, and he had a really bad drug trip where he said he met Satan. And then the next day he's sitting in a park trying to sort of understand his life. And then he meets the Children of God and kind of finds his place with them. I think one of the things when we study high control groups, which is another thing we can call cults or the military, is that it gives you some things. I say cults do some things right. And they give you community. They give you mission, purpose. And especially when the world is confusing, and especially when social systems are falling apart, or we as individuals are searching for a new way to live life, it's really easy to fall into these groups. And then, you know, how cults differ from groups is they kind of ramp up the isolation and then logic breaks down, but you can't see it because you're isolated in these groups.
Yeah, I think one of your rules is that the first rule of cults is you're never in a cult.
Yes, exactly. You know, and you see the story in Uncultured where 2 years after I have already, quote unquote, left the family, right? Been excommunicated, my religion and life that I'd known, already come to the U.S. in school, and an event happens on the news and I hear the word cult applied to Children of God. And that is when I realized. And looking back, it's like we had pamphlets on how we were in a cult. We memorized it. We had arguments. If you spend that much time talking about how you're not a cult, you're probably a cult. But it's so hard to see that from inside.
One of the things I did read about your life pretty early on is you were questioning the cult's persecution complex, which was a major part of the cult, and some of the lies about the group's conducts that members were taught to repeat when confronted with authority, like civil authority, from a pretty early age. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, you know, I think what's interesting is because the first rule of cults is you're never in a cult, they kind of forget to brainwash the children, or not forget to, but, you know, forgetting toxic control on adults, the adult kind of commits to it a little bit and goes along with it. And there's all of these models of toxic control. But children just always question things. We just do, no matter how suppressed we are. And so we're like, maybe they could convince the grownups that like the outside world says we're doing these bad things, but it's just persecution. I was there having the bad things done to me. So of course I knew it was a lie. And even though I was being taught, right, that the family was our place and the outside world was so bad, which of course I did also absorb, but I still knew deep down that like, maybe nothing else is as bad as this.
No, I get that. But at the same time, if you're raised in this experience from birth, what is normal? What is unnormal? What's not normal? I think that's probably difficult for a child to understand, and probably stays with you for, I mean, figuring that out is sort of oftentimes an adult issue, you know, because.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things for us raised in the cult is we don't have a normal, right? So in the ages of 1 to 6, children are developing their individual identities, and we don't have that. And one of the things that was really hard for me to shake was this notion that the outside world is evil. You know, I went through life very armored up, I think, for a long time because of that.
Yeah. In your book, you referred to the outside world as the systemic world. Is that how it was referred to?
Yeah. So, you know, you guys were all the system. That was the system we had had to drop out of and leave. And so the outsiders were called systemites, mm-hmm. right? So we had this very othering language.
My guest today is Daniela Mestenek Young, who was raised in the religious cult Children of God, left that cult at age 15, graduated high school, college, joined the U.S. Army, and was a captain in intelligence, and was a member of the female engagement team, which saw combat operations. She's written about her experiences in both in her memoir, Uncultured. It's published by St. Martin's Press. What made you decide to leave, and how difficult was that decision, given this had been your whole identity for your entire life?
Yeah, so the big decision for me was that the year of being 15 was sort of this extra indoctrination year where you get brought into the inner circle's doctrines. And when you're 16, you're an adult, which means essentially a lot of sex with no birth control. And I sort of knew that I had to get out. I had seen my mother go through sort of just being a womb for God her whole life. And I did not want that. I wanted to go to school. I did from a very young age. And so when I was 15, I was in like a really bad commune situation, and I just knew I needed to leave. So that's when I decided to sort of break the biggest, baddest rules, because if they think they can keep you, they try to save you. But if they think you're just lost, then that's usually when they just kick you out and get rid of you. So that was what happened with me.
You were in Mexico at the time. You had to cross the border. I mean, yes, the border is probably less, it was a little more easily crossable, but still you don't have papers. You don't have a lot of the things that let you know that you were an American citizen, even, much less being able to enroll in school and do that. How did that?
Yeah, I mean, I had a passport and a social security card, and that was it. And geez, borders always scare me because we were taught to fear that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in Uncultured, the chapter is called Dazed and Confused, because I'm literally 15, never been in school for a day, trying to get enrolled as a, you know, sophomore or junior in high school with nothing. And she said to me, you know, you do not exist.
Yeah.
And that was just because you really don't have anything that you know about the world just at all.
I can't imagine that deep well that must have been. What sort of tools did you use to understand better this world that you'd been taught to eschew, to fear, and to avoid at all costs?
You know, I read a lot. I'm a very good reader, and mm-hmm. I finally was given access to books. I want to say my senior year of high school, I read 250 books.
Wow.
And I, you know, eventually went into also study literature and history in college, which was just, I avoided science and math like the plague because I couldn't pass any of it. And I just threw myself into humanities, which to me was the study of, you know, how the world works. And it teaches you to be very analytical, which is sort of what I always was, and then what I very much used in my work as an intelligence officer.
Describe to me the thinking that went into joining the U.S. Army. As you mentioned, the Army military is a high control group, just as a cult is. On one hand, I could see it would be something that had some appeal because, as you write in the book about, you know, the discipline abuse, the mental abuse, as well as physical and sexual abuse, but that sort of breaking down and molding process could be appealing. On the other hand, I could see where you might want to run as far away from it as possible. What was the attractant for you?
You know, for sure, I spent 6 years just very lonely, kind of trying to survive in America, not knowing how to break into social circles, get along with people, which leads me to end up in a pretty emotionally abusive relationship. And which also scholars call a 1-1 cult. You know, and that in a way drove my decision. But I also think I was just, you miss the group, you miss the community. And I graduated from college was the scariest thing. I think if I hadn't joined the Army, I would have a PhD because I would have just stayed in school in that group with a guide. And towards the end of my bachelor's degree, I had worked so hard that I remember looking forward to basic training because I knew I wouldn't have to think. I would just have to be right place, right time, right uniform. And nothing like that they think is physically challenging was going to be that challenging for me because I can get through anything. So I think, you know, all of my thinking wrapped up, I didn't realize the group dynamics at the time, but I see it very clearly looking back.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have to agree with you. For I think a lot of people, you know, that day after graduation of college is some of the most scariest of all because it's like, what now? So I want you to know that's normal. but certainly when you went into the Army, I can see that idea of belonging. And I assume a lot of the tasks that the Army instills was very familiar and probably comforting in a way.
Yeah. And, you know, Rich, like the prologue of the book, which, you know, seems to be pretty memorable, is sort of me at the scene in basic training doing this impossible, sort of ridiculous physical task. And I have the thought, oh, I just joined another cult. And that wasn't a panic. That was, oh, I know how to do this, right? Like I survived like this for 16 years. These kids in basic training, the hardest thing for them was not being alone with their own thoughts, which is a part of mind control. And to me, it was like, you know, I was never went anywhere by myself till I was almost 16 years old. So it was something that I think was comforting, was familiar, the militarism, the sort of parallels of being a soldier in God's army, a soldier in Uncle Sam's army. You know, I knew how to do this. I was pretty surprised by the sort of sexual harassment, sexual violence climate being, you know, another strong parallel.
Yeah. But certainly you write in the part about the cult that they're little persecution drills where, I mean, that sounds like an army drill in many ways. It sounds like a basic training drill.
Oh, absolutely. And my editor was the one that says about these basic training chapters in the book where I start having these flashbacks. She's like, you're having PTSD in basic training, yeah. Right? Because my entire life was sort of battle drills for the end of the world. I mean, when we were 12 years old, 10 years old, like our games were running away from Antichrist soldiers, preparing for the apocalypse, shooting lasers out of our fingers, very similar to what you're doing in basic training on a like a field exercise.
Right. At what point did you realize that the rape and sexual violence culture in the military was, you recognize these parallels? Was it once you were deployed or once you had left basic training or when exactly?
I think, you know, I found out in basic training about the combat ban that kept women out of like the main roles in the Army. And I knew then that was bad, that was dangerous. And I saw women not being listened to and always sort of being second class. But it wasn't till, you know, I'm 23 years old, I get deployed to my first Army base in Afghanistan, which is, again, another big commune surrounded with high walls, topped with barbed wire. I'm shut in there. And women are less than 5% of the population on base. And it was, you know, told to me in a variety of ways by my bosses, like, be careful, getting raped happens to women. Getting raped is a hazard of wearing the uniform, essentially. And it was very triggering for me. And it woke up kind of all of these repressed memories or things I thought I had gotten over, ran far away enough from in my childhood, and really all came back for me to deal with on a very difficult deployment.
And of course, you know, your superiors would talk about that, but if it actually occurred, the mentality was, you're a member of the military. Do not bring attention to yourself. Do not detract from unit readiness. Do not do anything that sort of diverts the unit from whatever its goal is at that time, whether it's pacification or finding out intelligence or whatever. If you say anything, you're detracting from that, which again, that makes you even more suspect, correct?
Yes, and that's exactly what it is. You know, and in these high control groups, your number one goal is supposed to be not to stand out. As a woman, you stand out right from the beginning, right? That first day when they get their heads shaved and we don't, and you know, you're just different. And so any soldier that raises their hand to ask for medical care gets some of the same treatment as we hear about. But, you know, what happens very often when people are sexually assaulted, and, you know, I did experience this in Afghanistan with my own assault, where it's, you know, I can't bring it up. I cannot ask for help because it will absolutely 100% end my career. Like, maybe I'll get help, maybe I won't, but my career will be over. And so it was this very, very identical experience of within the sex cult of like, we all know what's going on behind these closed locked doors, but we don't talk about it. And if you do talk about it, you know, in the military, it becomes, you see, this is why women shouldn't be in the army, instead of like, no, why, you know, why are the rapists in the army?
Yeah, that's a good question. That is an excellent question. Well, you did join this female engagement team, which is a wonderful army euphemism. What exactly was that, and why did you make that decision?
Yes, army word games are fun. You know, I was always going to make that decision. I think I actually, at that time, saw the writing on the wall that they were going to start letting women go to Ranger school, and I was just always so gung-ho, I think, to prove myself, to prove I existed, and to prove that women could do it, right? That we women, we know we are equal to the men, and we know that we can do things, but, you know, they won't let us try. So when it started happening, they needed, essentially, once the U.S. realized they were fighting an insurgency, that means you need to do it differently. You need to win the hearts and minds of the local population. And because the local population is this very conservative Muslim population, we need women on the teams to be there, to be the ones that cordon and search the women and children, for example, or engage with them, right? Sit down and have tea, these different kinds of things. And, you know, it was very interesting, of course, because we've always kept women out of deliberate combat, thinking that you need to be men to be able to do combat well. And what actually happened here is the very fact that we were women was why they needed us. And I think, you know, in Uncultured, you see a couple examples of what us being women brings to the fight. And, you know, it did really quickly change the military. And I did not become one of the first Rangers, but I got to watch them graduate Ranger school on my second deployment, not even 2 years later, which was really thrilling.
One of the questions you ask in the book is about the difference between a good organization that is high control and a cult and its negative influences. And you're trying to understand the difference and where that line is. Did you feel like you reached any answers?
You know, one of the answers is I think that all groups share like 99% of the same DNA. Just like we say, all human minds are kind of 99% the same. It's the 1% difference that causes all these problems. I think people don't look at cults as groups. I mean, I literally was denied by Harvard adding psychology of cults to my organizational psychology degree because they said it wasn't enough about groups. Hmm. And so looking at cults as just the most extreme form of group, I think tells us a lot with what we think of as normal structures that go towards toxic control. Because what we cult survivors observe is nobody can ever portray a cult correctly because they're always trying to make it seem so different. But really, cults are not that different. They're a group of generally good people that united around a mission, that built up all of these structures, just like any company or any organization. And then with isolation, the logic can, doesn't always break down, but the logic can break down, but we can't see it because we are so isolated in that.
We're in many ways emerging from isolation, and in many other ways, we're still very much isolated from those with different ideas, thought processes than say us, I'm wondering if you believe that we as a nation, because of our cultural, political, and societal divides, are we particularly vulnerable to cults today?
So I call what's happening right now the culting of America. And I think that AI has so much to do with it. You know, in my grandfather's day, to get the level of isolation required for this kind of extreme toxic control, you had to isolate people in your communes because all Americans are, you know, watching the same television, listening to the same radio, interacting with a shared reality. But now with AI, you literally have, I mean, everything's contested. Nobody believes each other. Nobody knows what truth is, which is, you know, the first thing tyrants do when they want autocratic control is get people to question truth. So I absolutely think that this is what we're seeing in America, and we are seeing this extreme polarization that is very reminiscent of cults and how they operate.
And the digital world can be very self-isolating. You can have open doors, you can walk out into the world, but you can also sort of seal yourself off, find a like-minded group in the same ways in through digital culture.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to hear commercials you don't like anymore. You can skip them or tell them to feed you what you like, right? And so this is very kind of echo chambery, and it's on all of us to make sure that we are getting outside of our silos.
Now, you left the Army over an incident with a colleague and a warrant officer, and, you know, I'm sure that incident didn't end satisfactorily. But there have been a number of recent developments in regard to the exposure of sexual abuse in the armed services and in the Army, legal remedies for soldiers who have been an assault victim. Do you have any sense that the armed services are really ready to come to terms with the sexual abuse problem in the military and sort of, as you mentioned earlier, change the equation from why do we have rape allegations to why do we have people who are raping in the services?
So based on the fact that they still fight back every time, you know, senators are trying to remove sexual assault from the chain of command, they fight it. That in and itself sort of tells me the military is not really trying to deal with this. And there have been some recent good developments. It was just declared by the Court of Appeals that rape should no longer be considered incidental to military service, which means service members can sue. Like, that could make changes, but when the Army wanted to change the culture of DUIs and drunk driving, they, in 10 years, they completely reversed it. And I have not seen that kind of sort of effort or will from them yet. And I think when they want to address it, they can absolutely change the culture.
Daniela Mestanek-Young is a former U.S. Army intelligence captain and was raised in the religious cult Children of God. She writes of her experiences in Uncultured, a memoir. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.